Chautauqua, New York, 12th of August 2022. Rows of empty tiered seating.
The amphitheater seats over 4,000 people. We were briefly introduced. The audience applauded. Then, in the corner of my right eye, down the right-hand side of the seating area, I saw the man in black, black clothes, black face mask. He was coming in hard and low. One of the first things I thought when I saw him coming at me, bro, it's you. So it's you.
Oh my God!
The right lens of Salman's spectacles is tinted dark brown. A blurred reconstruction of a frenzied blade stabbing. Then an image of Salman Rushdie's face prior to the attack. Video from moments afterwards.
Witnesses said Sir Salman Rushdie was stabbed around a dozen times. The aftermath of the attack was caught on video. Audience members at the literary event in Chautauqua were horrified at what they'd just seen.
I did wonder if somebody was going to jump out of an audience one day.
A gleaming knife blade angled slowly between text. Salman Rushdie through a glass darkly. A clip from Ridley Scott's film Gladiator.
I had a dream two nights before. Nightmare. In which I was being attacked. And it was in a kind of Roman amphitheater with a gladiator. I was on the ground and with him stabbing downwards. It was quite a bad dream. And I woke up from it, and it stayed with me, you know. And I knew I was supposed to go to Chautauqua 2 days later and speak in what was also an amphitheater, you know. And it just felt, I don't know that I believe in premonitions, but it felt like a premonition. And I remember saying to Eliza, I don't want to go.
He was fighting and he was yelling and he was shouting and kicking. And I was shaking him awake. And he said, you know, I've been fighting in my sleep. Someone was attacking me and I was fighting them and I was rolling away and they were bringing these spears down. And he said, I don't want to go to Chautauqua.
And then I thought, you know, it's a dream.
And he thought, this is for writers who need support and need protection and need havens. So I should go to Chautauqua. It's a good gig.
Everybody's bought tickets, and I should go. So I went.
Breaking news tonight after author Salman Rushdie was attacked.
भारतीय मूल के प्रसिद्ध लेखक सलमान रुश्दी पर
तो इस हफ्ते सलमान रुश्दी पर हुए अटैक के बाद
cops have identified the man who stabbed Rushdie. The suspect has been identified as 24-year-old Hadi Mathur.
Thursday, 11th of August 2022. Knife.
Thursday, August the 11th had been my last innocent evening. As I think about that last carefree night, the shadow of the future falls across my memory. Except strangely, it's really the past returning. My own past rushing at me, not a dream gladiator, but a masked man with a knife seeking to carry out a death order from three decades ago.
The Ayatollah Khomeini this morning sanctioned the death of the author Salman Rushdie.
The Ayatollah Khomeini has ordered Muslims to kill a British author on sight.
I inform the proud Muslim people of the world that the author of the Satanic Verses book is against Islam, the Prophet, and the Quran, and those involved in its publication who were aware of its content are sentenced to death. A copy of the Satanic Verses is burnt in a violent protest.
The crisis around the book had been building up for months. It was publicly burned in Bradford. And just 2 days before the fatwa, five protesters were killed in Pakistan.
Rushdie, you are dead, the demonstrators shouted. And for the first time, he thought they might be right. Violence begat violence. Blood will have blood, he thought.
I had come to think of that whole episode as being ancient history. And I had been living more or less a pretty ordinary life for more than 20 years here in New York. And so there was a kind of shock to see this figure which felt like, as I say in the book somewhere, I felt like a time traveler. It felt like somebody coming out of the past to attack me in the present.
Knife.
The last thing I'd posted on Instagram was my photograph of the full moon over Lake Chautauqua, taken the night before the attack. On that last night, I stood alone outside the guest house and looked at the full moon brightly shining down on the lake. The first kings of the empire in South India claim descent from the moon god. I'd liked the idea that lunar deities had descended from the satellite to Earth, instead of mere earthlings going up to the moon in a ship oddly named after the Greek sun god, Apollo.
This is Apollo Control, Houston, at 100.
I thought about the apocryphal story of Neil Armstrong setting foot on the moon and muttering, "Good luck, Mr. Gorsky."
There he is. There's a foot coming down the steps.
Stand by.
Archive film of an astronaut bounding across the moon.
And I thought about The Distance of the Moon, Italo Calvino's story about a time when the moon was much closer to the Earth and lovers could leap up to it for moon trysts.
Downright shame you gotta be rushing off again.
And I thought about Tex Avery's cartoon Billy Boy about the little goat that ate the moon. This is the way in which my mind works. Eventually, I also remembered the early cinema classic about the first men to reach the moon, traveling in a bullet-shaped capsule fired from an immensely long cannon. I had no idea, as I remembered the image of the spaceship wounding the moon's right eye, of what the next morning had in store for my own right eye.
From the silent 1902 film A Trip to the Moon, to a green street sign for Chautauqua Street.
I raise my left hand in self-defense. He plunges the knife into it.
Salman touches the right side of his jaw.
He hit me here. And I thought he just punched me. You know, I thought he just punched me very hard. I didn't realize there was a knife in his hand. And then I saw the blood coming out, and I realized there was a weapon. And then he just started, I think he was just slashing wildly at everything. So there was a very big slash here across my neck, as well as the stab wound here. And then in my face, there was a wound here, which there's a scar, you can, it's slightly disguised by my beard, but there. And there was a slash across my forehead. And there were wounds down the middle of my torso, is 1, 2, 3, like that. And there are two of them, the side over here, and one on my thigh over here, and then there was the wound in my eye, which went as far as the optic nerve, which is why there's no possibility of saving the eyesight at all. It looked terrible. I mean, it was very distended, swollen, and it's kind of hanging out of my face, sitting on my cheek like a soft-boiled egg. I remember lying there, but there was enormous quantity of blood. I mean, it was quite spectacular quantity of blood all around me. And I remember thinking that I was dying. And I thought about it quite unemotionally. You know, it was just kind of matter of fact. That's what's happening. What's happening, Salman, to you is that you're dying.
He's speaking to Alan Yentob.
Red Rum is going to win the national.
Was close to delirious. Red Rum is murder backwards. This is the kind of random nonsense that was cropping up between my ears. Cut his clothes off so we can see where the wounds are.
There's urgency in the crowd around Salman on the stage at the venue. People have clustered around him.
That while this was happening, something extraordinary happened in that the audience jumped onto the stage and
saved my life. No, I mean, there's no question. I mean, first Henry Rees, who I was about to have the conversation with. And Henry is not a young man, you know, Henry's in his 70s, you know, and he's facing a 24-year-old man with a knife.
At the time, you know, I looked, I see this guy, and I sort of had a sense that it was a joke, like the Oscars or something, like those kind of things. And I thought it was a really bad prank.
Henry ran across the stage and tackled him. And then members of the audience ran up and helped him. I would not be here if it wasn't for that.
And it wasn't until you realized it was real that you acted.
How are you doing and how are you feeling in the aftermath of this attack?
Our mission is to protect writers who are in sanctuary, and to see Salman Rushdie assaulted for his life is unimaginably... It strikes... It's hard to describe what it is to see that happen in front of you. The writers in our program were in the audience watching this.
Authorities say the man, seen here, attacked the author as he was about to give a lecture at the Chautauqua Institution.
The suspect has been identified as Haiti Matar, age 24, from Fairview, New Jersey.
You were bleeding profusely from your neck.
And there was a man helping you. You called him the Thumb.
Yeah, because what he did, I mean, my memory of him, again, my memory is not reliable. My memory is that he was a big guy. And so he had a big thumb. And he put his big thumb over the worst injury, which was in my neck, in order to reduce the flow of blood. And he just kept it there, all the way from the soon after the attack until I was in the helicopter. The thumb did a great deal to help me.
The suspect is also a Lebanese national.
One piece of luck is that the weather was good. If the weather had been bad, the helicopter couldn't have flown. That would have been the end of that. I was no longer perceiving anything clearly. I felt the air beneath us.
I felt like the floor dropped out from beneath me. I didn't know if he was alive. I just started screaming. I just... This was the worst day of my life. I needed to be where he was.
One of the senior surgeons said, you know, when they brought you from the helicopter, we didn't think we could save you. I think somebody put some anesthetic over my face. I lost consciousness. There was eight and a half hours of surgery, with multiple surgeons working on different parts of me simultaneously.
Traveling through a hospital ward.
Hallway was lined with men in uniform. And then they opened these doors, and Salman was just lying there in a medical bed, and he had a large ventilator that was coming out of his nose and mouth. The room was eerie and quiet. And I just remember the sounds of the machines and the ventilator breathing for him. And I took a step toward him and felt like I was almost just going to faint because I knew he had come out of surgery, but he just wasn't moving. He wasn't responsive. Salman was fighting to live.
The hospital at night. Knife.
Deep into the night, hearing the night howls of dying men in other rooms. The biggest question, life or death, hung in the air, and there was no clear answer.
And put on a ventilator.
Yeah, because they weren't sure that I could that I could survive without it. They said that the first 24 hours would be very important. It's like having an armadillo's tail shoved down your throat. Imagine. And when they remove it, it's like having an armadillo's tail pulled out of your throat. So if you can avoid it, avoid it.
Jill and I were saddened to learn of the vicious attack on Salman Rushdie yesterday in New York.
Did you hear President Biden's statement?
I heard it in a rather beautiful way. When I came out of anesthetic, Eliza's brother-in-law came and sat beside me right here by my ear. And he said, I'm going to read you what President Biden said. And he whispered it into my ear. And it was unbelievably moving.
Salman Rushdie, with his refusal to be intimidated or silenced, stands for essential universal ideals. Truth, courage, the ability to share ideas without fear. These are the building blocks of any free and open society.
A supportive crowd.
On day 7 at 11 a.m., Eliza's laptop was set in front of me so that I could watch friends and allies gathering to declare their solidarity.
Salman, my dear old friend. We gather to stand with Salman, our stalwart comrade who is enduring agony wrought by a 33-year-old vendetta.
After I was attacked, they were the first people to organize an event in my support, which happened on the steps of the New York Public Library.
The honey-colored pillared entrance to the Chautauqua County Courthouse.
Prosecutors are overseeing charges against the 24-year-old suspect. He did enter a not guilty plea when it comes to those two charges that were filed against him, attempted murder as well as assault.
He had a fake ID. The first name and last name were both the names of well-known Islamic extremists. So I don't know what his plan was.
And he had a bag of knives.
And yeah, the officer said that when he arrested the guy, the guy said to him that he'd left his backpack in the auditorium. And the police officer said, is there a bomb in the backpack? And he said, no, there are knives. And they went and found the backpack. You would think it's difficult enough to get one weapon into an auditorium, but to take a bagful? 20 years ago, the novel that became Shalimar the Clown was born out of a single image that I couldn't get out of my mind. The image of a dead man lying on the ground, while a second man, his assassin, stood over him holding a bloodied knife. When I think about that now, I'm shaken. It's hard not to see the image as, at the very least, a foreshadowing.
As for the suspect, Hadi Bitari, the question is the motive.
What motivated this man?
I have no idea. He took very little trouble to inform himself about the man he was planning to kill. In that New York Post interview, he'd said he'd read a couple of pages. He didn't say of what. And that he'd watched a couple of YouTube videos and decided that I was disingenuous.
Disingenuous.
And therefore, right to kill. And that's all he knew. He looked absurdly, almost endearingly young. And in his calm demeanor, it was possible to imagine the folly of ignorant youth. I know I did the right thing, and I don't care who says otherwise.
The man's police mugshots.
What made you decide in the book to refer to him as A?
I really don't want to use his name. You know, I don't want to give him the oxygen of publicity. You know, so I thought I would use some euphemism. And I thought so many words, you know, attacker, assailant, adversary, begin with A. So I thought I would just call him the A. They decided to remove the ventilator. I was able to breathe well by myself. And I opened my mouth, and out came words. I can talk.
The moment I realized that he was going to come through, I just looked around and I thought, this is where I'm going to be until we are both able to leave this place together. There was a kind of ledge. And that was where I slept about 18 or 20 days.
The worst thing Eliza had to watch was my eye. At that point, the eye was still swollen, but the swelling had gone down somewhat. The doctors proposed to lower the eyelid and then stitch it shut. and the eye would be safe from further harm. What further harm could there be, I wondered. I'd had nightmares about my eye being pulled out of my head, dreams reminiscent of Un Chien Andalou, the surrealist film by Luis Buñuel and Salvador Dalí, in which a cloud slicing across the full moon becomes a razor blade slicing through an eye.
Here's these real events, and yet somehow there's a sort of magic realism about the way you describe it.
Back in the real world, they said to me it would not be painful because there would be a lot of local anesthetic, and, you know, they lied. it was unbelievably painful.
I watched as this needle went through the skin of his eyelids, and it was terrible. Someone didn't cry out that much, but I just held his hand. At one point, I thought I was going to pass out. I mean, I saw spots in front of my eyes, and I just thought, this cannot be our life now.
Knife.
Monday, August the 15th, was the day on which it became clear that I would continue to live. Midnight, August 15th, had always had a special meaning for me.
1947.
That was the moment India had attained independence from British rule.
I was born on August the 15th, 1947. On the stroke of midnight, as a matter of fact, clock hands joined palms in respectful greeting as I came. Oh, spell it out, spell it out. At the precise instant of India's arrival at independence, I tumbled forth into the world.
At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom.
You almost share a birthday with the central character of Midnight's Children and with India itself.
Probably grew out of a family joke, which is that I was born 2.5 months before the British left, and there was this joke that there was some relationship between the two events. When I sat down to compose the book, I just thought it would be funnier to make it exact. And so the book really does arise out of that insane coincidence and then suggests that there's something magical in that and that the child and the country become twins.
There's a sense of the voice telling you a story, which is quite unlike the tradition of the English novel.
There's an oral storytelling tradition, which every village knows about. People gather around and old men with white beards tell stories.
Were you told stories as a child by old men with white beards?
Not old men with white beards, but my father, yes. My father used to tell me stories as bedtime stories. And, I mean, I don't know now how many he made up and how many he was simply retelling that previously existed, but those stories were important for me because they were a lot of the sort of seed material for the way I think about storytelling. Because I think, you see, the realism in the novel, even in England, is relatively recent, and realism in storytelling in India never existed. There was a sort of belief that stories should clearly be lies and they should clearly be untrue. They should be wonderful tales, and that they didn't have to conform to the descriptions of the literal world.
It's a child's eye view of India, and like a fairy story, Rushdie gives Salim and the other Midnight's children magical powers. Salim can mind travel across the subcontinent at will, entering the head and sharing the thoughts of any of India's 600 million inhabitants.
At one time, I was a landlord in Uttar Pradesh, my belly rolling over my pajama cord as I ordered serfs to set my surplus grain on fire. I occupied briefly the mind of a Congress party worker, bribing a village schoolteacher to throw his weight behind the party of Gandhi and Nehru in the coming election campaign. Also, the thoughts of a Kerala peasant who had decided to vote communist.
Ben Kingsley.
There's a sort of motif in the novel where I talk about fare dodgers. What people do is they wait just beyond the platform and leap onto the outside of the train before it's really gathered speed and then cling on and hammer on the doors and ask to be let in very piteously. There's quite often large numbers of them clinging on, so if you actually open the door, you get this invasion of 18 or 19 people who frequently have gun belts, knives.
Did you go on a lot of trains as a child?
I went on quite a few, yes, because my father originally came from Delhi, and so he every so often used to take me on trips to Delhi with him. And they were very exciting things.
We grew up in a secular but Muslim family, but aware of there are areas that you don't touch. One of the important things that Salman did was to throw open that door. Things don't have to be out of bounds. You can talk about anything.
When, during the smoother passages of their bumpy journey as father and son, they argued passionately about the world, they both knew that although they disagreed on many topics, they had the same cast of mind. Everything, even Holy Writ, could be investigated and just possibly improved.
Archive film of a train passing through a station with people clinging to the outside. A black and white Rushdie family photograph. Knife.
I wasn't getting on with my father, who had become, among other things, an angry drunk. My sisters and I had been aware of his nocturnal rages, but our mother had done her best to shield us from them. In January 1961, I flew with him to England to begin my boarding school life. Before the beginning of term, we were together in London for several days. We were sharing a hotel room, and I soon learned that Johnny Walker Red Label would be sharing it as well. Those cold January nights at the Cumberland Hotel were traumatic. I would be shaken awake by my father in the small hours after he and Johnny had reached the bottom of a bottle, and he would abuse me in language I'd never heard. All I could think about was getting away from him.
To middle-class Indians of my parents' generation, the British public school was the acme of educational possibility. And so they decided that they wanted me to go to one and sent me. So I went to Rugby. I had a certain amount of racist trouble with people writing slogans on the wall of my room and tearing up my essays for me and nice things. And suddenly I realised that I didn't actually belong.
He didn't tell his parents what school had been like until after he left it, so in his letters home, he created his first fictions about idyllic school days of sunshine and cricket.
After having been very unhappy at boarding school, I was very happy at Cambridge. I studied history. One of the subjects I chose was about Muhammad and the rise of Islam. That was the year in which I first came across the incident of the Satanic Verses.
At the gates to Mecca stood temples to three goddesses, winged goddesses like exalted birds or angels. The wealthiest families in Mecca controlled the temples, and much of their wealth came from offerings. In the building known as the Cube, or Kaaba, in the center of town, there were idols of hundreds of gods. One of these statues, by no means the most popular, represented Allah, meaning the god, just as Allat was the goddess. The man who would pluck Allah from near obscurity and become his prophet was Muhammad. If Muhammad could agree that the bird goddesses could be worshipped by followers of Islam, then the persecution of Muslims would cease. The Prophet came down from the mountain one day and recited this surah. Have you heard of the exalted birds? Their intercession is greatly to be desired. But later he returned to the mountain and came down abashed, to state that he'd been deceived on his previous visit, and the verses he had been given were not divine, but satanic, and should be expunged from the Quran.
The opening line of the Satanic Verses returned to haunt me. To be born again, sang Jibril Farishta, tumbling from the heavens, first you have to die. I was in the extreme trauma ward at Hamad for 18 days, 18 of the longest days of my life. Many parts of my body had to be fixed by an army of specialists.
You have names in the book for all these doctors who are attending you. Dr. Hand.
Yes, but
Dr.
I named Neck. Them by their function.
There's a posse of them.
Yes, Dr. Payne. He's the one whose work hurt the most. Because at one point there was an injury here which had affected the way in which saliva traveled into my mouth, and the saliva was actually leaking out of my face. So they had to bandage that. Then he had to drain it, which meant pushing bandage liniment into my face very deep and absorbing this. And that, let me tell you, that hurts. But in the end, they managed to mend it, and that, then the saliva started moving back normally into my mouth. So there was a lot to fix.
There was the catheter, of course, which was...
There was a catheter is really maybe the worst thing in the world. You know how in Orwell's 1984, if you're in room 101, what you meet in room 101 is the worst thing in the world. And the worst thing in the world is different for everybody. So for Winston Smith in 1984, the worst thing in the world is rats.
Not to me. To Julia, not to me. I don't care what you do to her.
For me, it might be a catheter. You know, to be frank, I just was finding it impossible to pee, to urinate. I felt like I needed to, but nothing would happen. And so what happens is your bladder starts filling up, and it gets dangerous. And when it gets to a certain dangerous level, they have to get the stuff out by other means. And that's, to insert a catheter into your penis. And really, again, if you can avoid that happening to you ever, take steps to avoid it. The top man said it was time to send me off to rehab. The little bags attached to my body were taken away because nothing was leaking into them anymore. My left hand was still immobile in its splint. Hopefully, no more liquid would collect beneath my lung. All the stab wounds and gashes seemed to be closed. Even Dr. Payne didn't need to squeeze any more saliva out of my face. Dr. Eye, Dr. Hand, Dr. Stabbings, Dr. Slash, Dr. Liver, Dr. Tongue, all began to sign off. My stitched-up eye was doing okay. I came back by road to a rehab hospital in Manhattan. New York City, it did my heart good to see it again. Its jolly laid streets, both generous and mean. So much talent in the air, so many rats underfoot. It's everything at once-ness. As the ambulette moved through Manhattan, I had the feeling of being back in my right place. Home. Arriving at Rusk Rehabilitation was somewhat macabre because everyone was anxious that I not be seen, preferring an anonymous arrival that didn't alert the paparazzi.
When I first saw the damage that was done to him, he was 10 different colors. I immediately felt if Salman sees the condition of his body and his face, he will attach himself in some kind of way to what is being reflected back at him. And so I insisted, please, no mirrors.
For many weeks, Eliza refused to let me look into a mirror, so I had no idea how awful I looked. Doctors and nurses would come to inspect me and say, you're looking much better. And I believed their lies because I wanted to.
He trusted me when I said, wait until that moment when you look at yourself. And so we were in New York at the rehabilitation center, and, almost a month had gone by, and they had a mirror in the bathroom. And he was then able to have that moment and see himself. That was a hard moment for him.
A man sees his reflection and isn't sure he recognizes himself. Who are you? He asks the figure in the mirror. Do I even know you? Are you the ghost of my future? A ghost from the past.
He's just a person lost, locked away, and the keys are thrown away. Finding a way to carry on. I think that must have been incredibly hard.
For 2 years, he'd been heading down a road towards the heart of darkness. He saw himself swaying on the edge of a great abyss.
Andrew Wiley, literary agent.
I don't think people can imagine the pressure of living in small rooms without an ability to go out. Completely uprooted, moving from one room to the next because of perceived and real threats.
Satan, being thus confined to a wandering condition, is without any certain abode. For though he has, in consequence of his angelic nature, a kind of empire in the liquid waste or air, yet this is certainly part of his punishment, that he is without any fixed place allowed him to rest the sole of his foot upon.
A grey-bearded Salman travels in the back of a car, then walks with bodyguards. Zafar Rushdie.
What's very weird is to think that it's not weird to go out with four armed men in two armoured bulletproof cars to drive 40 minutes in the wrong direction, change cars in a car park for a cinema somewhere, get into two more armoured bulletproof cars with eight more armed men and drive back to where you were going in the first place, which sometimes was 10 minutes from the starting point. That was our normal way of getting places.
Portions of archive film are pixelated.
Even 4 years into the fatwa, Rushdie couldn't go to the toilet unaccompanied.
Once a building's toilets have been checked, Salman enters. Knife.
Live. Live. It was still whispering to me in my hospital bed. I found that at first I needed help moving my legs around, help sitting up, help sitting down. The day I was able to make it to the toilet and then clean myself without a nurse's help felt like a liberation. I have to learn the whole business of seeing again.
A poor drink misses a glass. Knife.
To be unable to see a whole quadrant of one's normal field of vision is hard to handle. One of the things about having two eyes is it gives you a kind of three-dimensional perspective that, to some extent, disappears when you've only got one eye. So you bump into things. You try and pour water into a glass and you miss the glass. But it's even more difficult emotionally. To accept that this is how it's going to be for the rest of my life, it's depressing. There's a thing that my mother used to say to us as children. She would say, what can't be cured must be endured. And I thought, okay, Mom. Still telling me how to behave. In my waking hours, I was trying to stay calm, optimistic. But when I slept, all my defenses fell away, and the night horrors came for me.
See it, shalt thou never.
I dreamed of being taken as a schoolboy to see King Lear.
Young Salman in a black and white school photograph.
Out. Find Jenny.
The blinding of the Earl of Gloucester returned to haunt me.
I've served you ever since I was a boy, but now I'll...
Have you always had an obsession with knives?
No, but I just think I have a kind of free associative mind, you know? So if you say knife to me, I think of eight knives. Polanski's Knife in the Water, a fable about violence and infidelity. Philip Pullman's subtle knife that can cut openings between worlds and allow the bearer to traverse multiple realities. And of course, the butcher's knife, with which the protagonist of Kafka's The Trial is killed on the book's last page. Like a dog, he thought. It was as if he wanted the shame of it to outlive him. And I thought, language is a knife. Language is a way of cutting things open and revealing the truth. And so then I thought, okay, so I find myself, I never in my life thought I wanted to be in a knife fight. But if I'm in a knife fight, I've got a knife too. Calling this book Knife is not just a description of the attack against me. The book is the knife. It's my way of fighting back.
Coils of razor wire on a fence. Knife.
I tried to imagine the cast of mind that would be willing to drive a blade into an old man's neck. Therefore, in this chapter, I have recorded a conversation that never occurred. He does not really want to talk to me. But as this is my imagination at work, he has no choice. I had this idea that I wanted to go and meet him and ask him why, you know. And then I thought, well, that's never going to happen. But first of all, if I was his lawyer, I wouldn't allow it, you know. And then I thought, you know, I could learn more by making him up than by meeting him. Use your skill. My skill is imagination. You know, imagine myself into his head. I've kind of had that conversation with him in my head for a year and a half now. Writer's instinct is to try and make sense of events, and this didn't seem to really make sense. I have to try and make him up, make him real. I clear my throat and begin. Can we start with the word disingenuous?
Why?
You used it to describe me to the New York Post. You said you found me to be a disingenuous person.
Okay, so? You are.
I'm asking you to tell me what you understand by the word.
It means you pretend to be telling the truth when you're not.
Yes, it does.
So fuck you, Mr. Smarty Pants.
Okay, let's leave disingenuous and look at another word. The word everybody.
That's stupid, it's an ordinary word.
Indulge me.
Everybody is all good people. People who know the devil when he comes to trick them. People who know right from wrong.
So, in your opinion, I'm not only disingenuous, I am the devil. Is that why it's right to kill me?
You're only a little devil, don't flatter yourself. But even a little devil is a devil.
And devils must be destroyed?
Yes.
These are views you have held for a long time, or are these new ideas?
I was ignorant. I was asleep. Now I'm awake.
What woke you up?
God woke me up.
How did he do it?
I studied, I learned.
From books? From people?
From Imam Yutubi.
Who is that?
You can find him on his YouTube channels. He has many faces, many voices, but they all tell the truth.
Don't consult with anybody in the killing of Americans. Fighting the devil doesn't require consultation or prayers seeking divine guidance.
I invented the Imam Yutubi. My guess is that he was listening to a lot of radical priests on YouTube. So I collected them under this one imaginary name. I studied the origins of your faith too, you know, at a British university.
You learn nothing.
Why do you say that?
You have a bad mind. A mind like a butterfly. It can't stay focused on what matters. It is an American mind.
But I am from India originally, from a secular Indian Muslim family. I have an Indian mind, and later a British mind, and now maybe, yes, also an American mind.
Secular is a synonym for liar. It is a sickness.
You're sure of that? Because my mother, for example, was a very truthful person.
She must have been ashamed to have you as a son.
Can we talk this morning about foreign travel? Do you like to travel abroad?
More stupid questions.
Do you believe that travel broadens the mind?
I have no interest in tourism.
But in 2018, you did leave America. You went to Lebanon.
I went to visit my father. That is the opposite of tourism.
Your mother says that at first you didn't like it there and wanted to come back right away.
My mother can say whatever she wants.
As I can piece his life together, what seems to have happened is his parents came from Lebanon, settled in New Jersey. They split up, and the father went back to Lebanon. Mother and his sisters and he stayed in New Jersey. And his mother and sisters seem like perfectly regular people. They're so, you know, not remotely fanatical, perfectly decent people. And apparently he was not different from them. Until at something like the age of 19, he went to Lebanon to visit his father. And according to his mother, he initially couldn't stand it and wanted to come back right away, but then stayed for only about a month and came back. And she said that when he came back, he was transformed. and that he attacked her for not having taught him properly about religion. And he sequestered himself in the basement of their house in New Jersey. She wasn't allowed to come downstairs, and nor were his sisters. And he lived like that for like 4 years.
You stayed a month and came back changed. So it seems travel did affect your mind. Something happened to you there that altered your whole personality. Then you came home and moved into your mother's basement and stopped talking to her and your sisters. What did you do down there?
Like you said, I played video games and watched Netflix and listened to Imam Utubi. This conversation is over.
No, no. The point about this is, it's happening in my head, so it's not over until my head says it is. You don't even have to think of things to say. I'll put the words into your mouth.
Then they will be worthless.
Animated with the assistance of AI.
My son, Milan, had been researching knife attacks. Dad, he said, sitting by my bed, there are so many cases where somebody gets stabbed just once and dies. And you got stabbed like 15 times and you're still alive. I nodded. You know, I told him, the fictional character with whom I now most strongly identify is Wolverine, the X-Man with the superheroic healing factor. That got a laugh.
Like you, didn't Samuel Beckett have a narrow escape on the streets of Paris?
Yeah. Beckett also was the victim of a knife attack. That he was approached by a pimp who wanted money from him. And he waved him away, and the pimp stuck a knife in him and almost killed him, narrowly missed his heart. Anyway, he was in hospital. And then when the trial of the guy happened, Beckett went. And at the end of the trial, in court, asked him, why do you do it? And the man replied, je sais pas, monsieur, je m'excuse. I don't know, sir, I'm sorry. And that's all he got, that's all he ever got.
The man in black and white film, his face obscured.
Do you have any idea what you will say in court?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be testifying, so I answer the questions I'm asked.
If Samuel Beckett could confront his pimp in court, then I could damn well confront mine.
A clip from the 1957 black and white film, The Seventh Seal.
At some point in that first 24-hour stretch after the surgery, I had dreamed of the famous scene from The Seventh Seal, in which the knight returning home from the Crusades plays a last game of chess against death.
Death wants to claim him, and he challenges death just in order to prolong his life so that he could get home to see people he cares about. The question is, how long can you keep the game going? There was one moment when I thought, okay, we're going home now. The first step of wanting your life back is to be able to come home, you know? And as I say, I was at hospital for whatever it was, close to 7 weeks.
You refer in the book to Wind in the Willows.
Yeah. One of the most beautiful moments in it is when the mole and the rat are wandering around in what they think of as strange territory.
Well, come on, old fellow.
Wherever you going to, Ratty?
We are going to find that old home of yours, so you'd better come along. We shall need your nose.
And the mole follows the scent and finds his mole hole.
In stop-motion animation, they arrive in darkness.
The moment I walked into my own house, I felt like 200% better.
Mole has lit a lantern. He wipes dust from a dresser with his fingertip.
It was this enormous surge of good feeling and strengthening. I felt stronger and better and healthier just from the joy of being home.
Knife.
Mole saw clearly how plain and simple it all was, but clearly too how much it all meant to him, and the special value of some such anchorage in one's existence. This place which was all his own, and could always be counted upon for the same simple welcome. Now, as my front door closed behind me, I was that humble mole, recognizing the smells of the place, my heart leaping as I saw the photograph of myself and my sisters reading Peter Pan. I was home.
Your house keys were on your mind that day.
Soon after the attack, I heard voices saying that they needed my clothes to be cut off me so they could see where the wounds were, you know. And I found myself half articulating that, you know, my house keys are in that pocket. And I heard somebody say, what does it matter? But in retrospect, what it says to me is there was some bit of me that was not intending to die. There was some bit of me that said, I'm going to need those house keys. What happens to human beings in an extreme situation, you know, when you're really, it's a matter of life and death, is that there's an immensely strong survival instinct that human beings have that kicks in. And I think that was that survival instinct that was saying to me, you're going to live, live, live.
When I was in my late teens, the prophet wasn't just a person to us. He was a way of talking about possibility. Why would anyone write such things about that? Kafka once wrote that literature is the axe for the frozen sea within us. And it was when I picked up the Satanic Verses, intrigued by what was being said about it, that I heard the seismic cracking sound of centuries of frozen things breaking open inside me. I remember on finishing the book sobbing uncontrollably, tears that came and went in torrents for 3 days. My dad couldn't understand. What the hell is wrong with you? It's just a book. It can't be that bad. I said, no, Dad. You don't understand. It's so beautiful. I said beautiful, and like Keats, what I really meant was true. Salman gave offense to awaken, and awaken he did. He awakened the malice of the mullahs and a generational outpouring of passionate support from across the planet, and in the process, he became a symbol of the writer imperiled by the products of his imagination, imprisoned for the sake of a freedom that was not just his to exercise, but also ours to learn from, ours to enjoy.
Ayad Akhtar, President PEN America. Now Salman Rushdie.
Terrorism must not terrorize us. Violence must not deter us. As the old Marxists used to say, la lutte continue, la lutta continua, the struggle goes on.
He raises a fist from the lectern, then waves.
But that same award, many years previously, had been given to some of the survivors of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris. When Islamic radicals murdered most of the staff of a magazine which drew cartoons.
Copies of the magazine packaged for distribution.
At that time in Paris, there were people holding up signs saying, Je suis Charlie, you know, I am Charlie. And to my surprise, a sizable number of American writers, PEN members, opposed the idea of giving them the award, because apparently they had offended against religion. And one of the things said about the cartoons is that they were disrespectful. Now, the point is, what is a respectful political cartoon? You know, there's no such thing. If we can't defend and honor our colleagues in the media who were murdered for drawing cartoons, then what are we doing? You know, may as well all go home. An important part of my life has been, first of all, to defend other writers in trouble,
because a lot of writers defended me when I was in trouble. And so it's a question of, as they say, paying it forward. But also the principles involved of free expression, which are so much in danger in so many parts of the world, for all sorts of different reasons. In some places for religious reasons, in some places for reasons of authoritarian governments, dictatorships, and in some cases because of ideological shifts. I mean, certainly in the West, there now is a shift in this younger generation in favor of censorship.
And writing the book, you told it the Philip Roth moment, shall I just stop this? And your agent just said to you, no, you can and you must write this book. But it took you a while to get round to that.
There was just this moment when, you know, kind of the juice started to flow again. And I thought, let me sit down and see what happens.
You know, it was a pendulum back and forth. No, I can't write about this. I must write about this. I won't write about this. I'm going to try to write about this. I remember just after the new year, Salman began to talk about writing what would become Knife. And that's when I also felt Salman is here. He's back.
Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder, Salman Rushdie.
To what extent is this a love story as much as a horror story?
I think it's at least as much a love story, you know, because, you know, the thing is, when you settle down to try and write a book about something like this, it's all very well to say, OK, this terrible thing happened, you know, but what's the book? What is the story you're trying to tell that will be interesting for people to read, you know? And it came to me that really there were two forces in collision here. You know, one was a force of violence, fanaticism, bigotry, you know, and the other was the force of love, you know, and in the end, the way I understand what happened is that the force of love proved to be stronger than the forces of hatred, you know, and I thought that's the story I'm trying to tell, you know, and of course the force of love is embodied in the figure of my wife, Eliza, who was astonishing in this period of time. Love is strengthening. Love is a force in the world. And when you are the recipient of a lot of it, it makes you stronger.
An airport.
It became clear to me at a certain point, separately from writing the book, just for myself, that I needed to return to the scene of the crime. Just in order to prove to myself that I had overcome it, you know, to literally to stand up in the place where I fell down.
The white and red brick Chautauqua bookstore, an inactive fountain stained with algae and moored boats on a lake.
It's a beautiful place. It's on a lake, it's very magical. And so there's this dissonant feeling. And then to think this attack happened to Salman. We came toward the auditorium. We went through a series of backstage doors. And suddenly we're coming out onto this stage. And for me, I just drew in, I gasped.
Taking the same route to the auditorium.
It's a very big space. And it was so quiet that day that we came. You could just hear the trees. It was exactly the kind of day that Salman had that Friday. When I was watching him walk me through it, I was crying. I was so upset. I could see this image of my husband bleeding out on this simple stage with all of these people trying to help him and save his life. And what I did see, which was so fantastic, there was this light in Salman His skin, it was like bright, and he was looking at me with his eye. And there was so much light that this, I knew, was the right thing for us to have come back there. And I could see it just like falling off of him. This kind of like heaviness, this weight, this violence and horror. And then it got bright for me too. And then we just hugged each other standing there. So tight. And he's like, let's go home now.
This is the door through which he was taken out. It was hard for her to hear that, but she held it together.
I remembered the question I had asked myself
after the attack. Could our happiness survive such a blow? Standing there, on the stage of the Chautauqua Amphitheater, I knew the answer. Yes, we had reconstructed our happiness, even if imperfectly. Even on this blue sky day, I knew it was not the cloudless thing we had known before. It was a wounded happiness. And there was, and perhaps always would be, a shadow in the corner of it. But it was a strong happiness nevertheless. And as we embraced, I knew it would be enough. We're done here, I said to Eliza, taking her hand. Let's go home.
Eliza looks emotional.